What a beautiful day. I mean, what a wonderful day. I hope you've had as good of one as I have. Actually, I hope you've had a better one than I have, but I don't know if that'd be possible. My day may or may not have started out with a couple of hours of fishing, but quickly after that, I did get into some work. And I worked most of the day. Don't make fun of me, but I got in my perfect push-ups and my power walk, so a little bit of exercise as well. And unfortunately, I felt like I ate all day long yet again. Thank you for that, but I'm about to burst at the seams. It's wonderful, and it is so very appreciated. But as great as the day has been with all those things, to get to culminate this day with something like this, and to get together and to worship God, that's awesome, isn't it? And then to get to do so with so many new friends I'm making in this congregation, and then so many old, that's not age, by the way, but old friends. We've been friends a while from other congregations in the area. What a wonderful thing. That is. I'm really enjoying these studies together, old truths for a new world. I hope the same could be said from your standpoint. I'm so excited about what the day has been, I could just burst out in song. But don't worry, I'm not going to sing to you. But I do want to tell you about the lyrics of a song. I want to tell you about the fourth verse of one of my favorite songs, In Christ Alone. You've probably heard it before. That song begins in the fourth verse, "No guilt in life, no fear in death, this is the power of Christ in me." I guess you could say these words could be adopted as the anthem of Daniel chapters 3 and 6, a theme which really carries over into our time and rings throughout eternity. How when we have the power of Christ at work in us as His servants, because we now have no guilt in life, we have no reason to fear, even in the face of death. And as Daniel is going to show us from chapter 6 of the book that wears his name, that when we have no guilt in our lives, we have no reason to fear death, even at the jaws of a hungry lion. Now, strictly from the human standpoint, Daniel had every reason to fear. And the reason I say that is he's a part of the Medo-Persian Empire, and under that, King Darius is ruling at this time. And he's made an edict, and the reason for that is at the suggestion of his wicked pawns who are just trying to harm Daniel. And they say, "King, why don't you make a decree that anyone who makes an appeal to anyone but you, any man or any god, for 30 days should be thrown into the den of lions?" And they'd be consumed down there. He said, "Yeah, I think that's a really good idea," not having Daniel in his mind. He likes Daniel. Unfortunately, he signs the decree before he realizes what's going on. And according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians, you sign a law and you can't revoke it. And so that's what's going to be experienced for Daniel. He has every reason to fear. Have you ever been inside of a cage with hungry lions? Yeah, me neither. I can only imagine, though, what that has been like. Probably all of us have been to a zoo at some point. Usually we go to a zoo through the day. And have you noticed how all the big animals are just so docile? Whenever you go, you're just laying. A lot of times you're just sleeping in a corner. And you think, man, are wild animals always like that? Well, one time I got to experience something a little bit different. My wife and I don't really recall why, but for some reason we went to the Dickerson Park Zoo in Springfield, and we didn't get there till like 4:30 or 5 o'clock at night. If you've never been to a zoo in the evening, that is the time to go. Number one, because you will almost see nobody else. And you will have the zoo all to yourself. And basically, we did. And it was really neat to see the animals, though. I saw them in a different way than I'd ever viewed before. As we were going through our speed walking tour of all the animals in about an hour in the zoo, it wasn't hard because there wasn't a crowd. But as we were quickly going through, I noticed as I went by all the big cats, and almost every one of them was up and just pacing around, and you could tell kind of some grunts that they were making. And then at one point, I got to hear a lion let out a roar, make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. You realize they're not so docile as what they look during the day at the zoo. You see what was going on? That's a natural time for feeding for animals at night. They're getting anxious, they're getting hungry, and they're ready for their food. When Daniel knows it's against the law to pray to his God, nevertheless, he opens his windows toward Jerusalem. He gets down on his knees, and in the plain sight of the people who hate him and want to kill him and help the king to make that edict, he prays three times that day, unashamed. You know why he prays? He wants to make sure he doesn't incur any guilt in life. And because he doesn't, he knows he has no reason to fear death even at the jaws of hungry lions. Well, those men take that information to the king, and Daniel is going to be thrown down into that den with those lions. Verse 16 of our text in Daniel 6. So the king gave the command. They bring Daniel. They cast him down in the place earlier specified. Verse 17. Then a stone is brought and laid on the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. Daniel has been thrown down not with one. We don't know how many, but the scriptures tell us there is a plurality of lions, a pride of them in which he now finds himself in company. What chance do you think Daniel has to survive? I'd like for you to raise your hand if you've ever seen the movie The Ghost in the Darkness. Okay, I knew no teenagers would be raising their hands. this dates me some, okay? Back in 1996, this film came out. It's an excellent film. I wouldn't recommend it without filtering or something, you know, on TV that's taking out a lot of stuff in it. But if you can do that, I would recommend watching it then. It's an excellent show. And it's actually based on a true story. In the late 1800s, there were these group of people that went into the country of Kenya in Africa, and they were trying to build a railway through there, but they ran into an issue. There are these two adult lions that start stalking the workers, and they begin picking them off one by one. They can't stop it. They have weapons, and they still can't stop these lions. And these are people in the prime of their lives. They got sharp eyesight, and they have good movement. They can't overcome these lions. And so they hire this guy to come in who's a professional hunter, and it takes him a period of time to take care of the matter. And by the time it's all said and done, for people who experienced it, they said 135 workers were killed and eaten by these lions. Now, modern historians will say, oh, it was only about 30. I'm going to choose to believe the people who were there and experienced, and not people who just heard about it 100 years later. Nevertheless, it's crazy stuff. But this guy, the first lion, it took two shots before he could bring it down on two different occasions. The second shot, he killed it. When they measured it from the tip of its nose to the end of its tail, it was almost 10 feet in length. The second one took about another month to bring down, and it was something like around 10 shots it took before it killed that lion. And the man who killed it said that final shot he put in it, this is according to the story, it was reaching up and it was clawing at the branch in which he was sitting in a tree. Now, these are grown men with weapons and a whole bunch of them, and they can't bring down a couple of lions. What chance do you think a guy has trapped in a cave with several lions? He's all by himself. He has no weapons. And according to historians, it's likely that he's an old man by this point. Could be as much in his 80s. What chance does Daniel have of survival? Verses 19 through 22, the king arises very early and he goes in haste. He hurries to the den of lions, and he cries with a lamenting voice. He's sad because he's afraid probably Daniel's dead. And he says to him, Daniel, servant of the living God, hopefully, has your God whom you serve been able to deliver you from the lions? We're going to encounter two statements that are made by pagan kings about the God of the Hebrews and who we know as well, the same God of the Christians. They don't have any idea the power of our God, do they? Has your God been able to deliver you from lions? You think the creator of lions might be able to take care of a few lions? Probably so. Daniel said to the king, my God has sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me. No fear in death. Why? Because I was found innocent before him and also before you, O king. That's no guilt in life. Because Daniel had no guilt in life, he had no reason to have any fear in death, even as he's standing before these lions. There's a quick statement I want to make. I want to try to be as clear about it as I can, but I don't want to waste time either in doing it. I want to give a suggestion. It's just something to consider. When we encounter the word angel in the scriptures, what comes to mind? Is it not a created heavenly messenger? And usually when that word is employed in the scriptures, that is the case. But that's not a translation of that term. It's a transliteration, meaning the Greek word angelos was taken and the equivocal characters were placed into English angel. I know this isn't Greek here. This is Hebrew. But it's essentially the same thing. Malak the Hebrew word, angelos, the Greek word, the meaning for that is messenger. And when that term is used, whether Old Testament or New, that's not always in reference to a created heavenly messenger. For instance, in Matthew chapter 11, the term is used of a created earthly messenger in John the Baptizer, but the word's translated and not transliterated, and so we don't get confused by it. It's messenger that's found there and not angel. Well, it's the same thing in Malachi chapter 3, verse 1. The Hebrew term malach, translated as messenger, is used for John the Baptizer in prophecy of him, but he's not the only one. It's also used in Christ, of Christ in prophecy in that very same location. And so many times when angel is used, the reference is to a created heavenly messenger, but in the case of John, it's used in relation to a created earthly messenger. Malachi 3:1, as it's used of Christ, it's talking about an uncreated heavenly messenger. And I say that for this reason. Just because we encounter the term angel, that translators didn't do their job and they transliterated instead of translated, that doesn't necessarily mean we're talking about a created heavenly messenger. It's obvious that this is a heavenly messenger who performs this deed, this miracle, but we don't know if he's a created or an uncreated one. There's a possibility. I'm not saying we know for a fact. There's a possibility here. This could be a reference to Jesus himself showing and closing the mouths of these lions. Whoever it is, whether a created or an uncreated being who did so, it's a good thing. You don't want to be at the business end of that proposition. You don't want to have one of these creatures breathing down your neck and then clamping onto you. You're going to be in big trouble. And so that's why God sends this messenger, whether created or uncreated, from heaven and closes these lions' mouths. But there's something else about which Daniel ought to be concerned. And that's what's found at the end of this creature's paws, and that's his claws. By the way, you want to know the difference between a lion's claws and a sentence, comma? You ever heard that before? You see that on Facebook a while back? Okay, I had a meme, I shared it. Well, the difference between a lion's claws and a sentence pause is that a lion's claws are found at the end of its paws, whereas a sentence, comma, is a pause in a clause. All right, that's your dumb preacher joke for the day. My take while I just said it. Hey, man, did I hear that? Okay. Yeah, no more of those. You don't want to get touched by those, right? Whether it's the mouth or whether it's the claws, it can do some real damage to you. Well, it could really scratch you up. I wonder how many scratches Daniel had on him, even though the lions couldn't put their mouths on him. We're told in verse 23, the king was exceedingly glad for him, and he commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. And so Daniel was taken up out of the den, and listen to this, no injury whatever was found on him. That's no fear in death, because he believed in his God. That's no guilt in life. When we have no guilt in life, we have no reason to fear, even when we're standing right before a hungry lion that wants to eat us. And that's what Daniel shows us. But what we're doing for all of these lessons, I know the congregation here knows it, and the visitors probably already recognize this anyway, but we're looking at these stories that are so old, but especially we're doing so with a view of, that's great, that's neat, that's historical fact for them, but what does it mean for us today in our time? Do you and I really need to be concerned about lions chasing us down and trying to eat us? No. Or do we? Peter writes this in his first letter, chapter 5, verse 8, be sober, be vigilant. Be sober means be serious-minded. Be vigilant means be watchful. Do you think those people, those workers in Kenya, in Africa, that they were joking around a lot when they keep getting picked off day by day and eaten by these lions? Or do you think the mood was pretty serious? Do you think they were sleeping with both their eyes shut, or do you think at least one, if not both of them, were open at all times? How serious are we about the lion that's after us? How watchful are we as he strolls around us? He crouches up to us and he starts breathing down our necks. Your enemy, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion. The reason he's doing that is he's hungry and he's seeking whom he may devour. You see, there's a lion that's still after us, just like there were lions that were after Daniel. But like Daniel, do we need to be concerned about that lion? It just depends on where we stand with God. Revelation chapter 20 reads in verses 1 through 3, John states, I saw a marvelous thing, one of the many in this book. He said, I saw an angel. Remember what that term means. It doesn't necessarily mean a created heavenly messenger. If translated, it would simply read, I saw a messenger, and we have to use the context to try to figure out, is he talking about a created earthly messenger, a created heavenly messenger, or is he talking about an uncreated heavenly messenger? But I saw a messenger having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand, and he used the chain to lay hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who's called the devil and Satan, and he bound him, he chained him up for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit. He shut him up. He set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more. I wish we had more time to go through Revelation chapter 20, but we don't. So I'm going to cut to the chase, and I ask you to grant me a little slack not having the time to explain all of these things thoroughly. Here's the Cliff Notes version of it, though. I'm convinced, based on what chapter 1 tells us in verse 18, this is not a reference to a created heavenly messenger here, but an uncreated heavenly messenger. And the reason for that, chapter 1, verse 18, tells us about Jesus and what he did for us. He was dead, but he rose from the dead. Now he's alive forevermore. And he says, now I have the keys of Hades and of death, the afterlife. And just like the book of Daniel does, it tells the same story about three or four different times in three or four different ways. I think the book of Revelation does the same thing in revealing what the contents of the book of Daniel is. And at the end, I think he's looking back toward the beginning in the early part of chapter 20, that's Jesus, the uncreated heavenly messenger, who now has victory over Satan. He controls the afterlife before Satan was in control of our eternities. But he's not any longer, is he? Jesus won that back from him. And the way that he did so, chapter 12 teaches us, casting Satan down from the high place in which he found himself, was when he was lifted up high above the earth. And when he rose from the dead, he won the victory over death, and now he's in control. And the hungry lion that loved to devour God's people, he's not in control of things any longer. Now, the rest of chapter 20 tells us that after this complete binding that takes place with him, that the time would come when he would be let loose for a short season. I believe that short season is right now. It's been going on for some time. And what it is Satan was allowed to regroup and to go after God's people, even though he's been bound for a time. Now he's able to go after people, including God's people, but it's now in a limited capacity. And he doesn't have the same confidence that he once did. And the reason for that is he knows he's vulnerable. He knows he's already been beaten. And when he is forcibly chained and he's thrown down from his high position of power that he once had, it hurt him whenever he did so. And now he's not after us just as a lion, but the most dangerous of all kinds of lions. And that's a wounded lion. You know, zoologists will tell you, you don't want to tangle with any lion, but you especially don't want to tangle with a wounded lion. He's not just wounded, he's also hungry. He wants us. And Peter says in his first letter, chapter 5, verse 8, he's on the prowl and he's after every one of us. And just like those lions in Kenya, Africa, 100 years ago, they acquired a taste for human flesh. This lion has acquired a taste for Christian flesh. That's what he wants more than anything else. The way to overcome this lion, though, is with God's help and following his will, is to have no guilt in our lives. And when we're God's child, it doesn't even matter if that lion's breathing down his neck. There's a special heavenly messenger, and I believe it's an uncreated one, that God has sent to watch over us. And so long as there's no guilt in our lives, that angel, so to speak, that messenger, keeps that lion's mouth closed and he can't hurt us. That's what Daniel shows us. When there's no guilt in our life, there's no reason to fear death, even at the jaws of a hungry lion. Then you have Daniel's three buddies, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, whom, for some reason, we know better by their pagan, godless given names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And what these three men demonstrate to us is when there's no guilt in your life, you don't have any reason to fear death, not even the fire of the hottest of flames. Now, from the standpoint of a human being, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had every reason to be afraid of a certain fire. There's another king of another kingdom. This is Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. And he's given the decree that based on this idol, it's beautiful to see, I'm sure. It's golden. That's the kind you'd want if you'd build one, right? And it's really tall. It looks like it's sturdy. And he builds this tall, beautiful, sturdy golden idol. And he says, anytime you hear this music kick in, you better hit your knees and fall on your face and worship my idol that I've set up. Because if you don't, I'm going to throw you in my burning, fiery furnace. By the way, you know why it has a burning, fiery furnace just sitting around? It's a lot bigger than the furnace that we have in our houses, and it goes a lot hotter than that. The reason that is there is to bake the bricks for the building of this magnificent Babylonian city, a part of which becomes one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And that's why he has that burning fiery furnace, to make those bricks to help build the city. Well, that music starts playing, and everybody, including all of the common Israelites who are in captivity, they all fall on their knees and on their faces. They're ready to worship this false god. And then there are three oddballs who are standing up, who stick out like a sore thumb. And the king's not very happy about it. Verses 13 through 15 of Daniel 3. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And Nebuchadnezzar spoke to them, "Is it true that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up?" It's really not about his God. It's about Nebuchadnezzar's ego. He wants people to do what he says, when he says, how he says it. They haven't done it. "If you do not worship them, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace." And here's your second pagan king statement, which is actually a question here of the night. "And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" He doesn't have a clue either, does he, who the God of the Hebrews is? He doesn't have any idea who the God of the Christians is, the same God that's the God of the Hebrews. Oh, I don't know. Do you think the God who creates kingdoms, and the God who has given the kingship to Nebuchadnezzar, and the God who makes fire might be able to deliver Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from this fire and from this king in his kingdom? He might be able to do so. Well, we find in verses 16 through 18, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answer the king, "Our God whom we serve is able to deliver us." Now, I know that's easy for us to say, yeah, that's what you ought. Can you imagine standing before the king, who's ready to murder you, and in such a cruel way by burning you alive, the most powerful man in the world? "Oh yeah, our God can take care of you, no problem." He can do it, but we don't know if he will. Now, this isn't a statement that lacks faith. It's just we don't understand what the Lord's plan for us is yet. But we know if his plan is to spare us, there's nothing you can do to us to kill us. That's no fear in death. Why? "But if not," verse 18, "let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." That's no guilt in life. Because they had no guilt in life, they knew they had no reason to fear death, even to be thrown into a burning, fiery furnace and to be consumed alive. They don't have any worries about that because they have no guilt in their lives. Verses 19 through 23 explains, "Then Nebuchadnezzar, full of fury, the expression on his face changed." We're not playing games any longer. "Spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace seven times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain men of valor in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. These men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, their other garments. They were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace, and the flame of the fire was so hot it killed those men who took up these three guys. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they fell down, bound, into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." I want to ask you something. At this point in time, based on the information we have, what chance of survival do these guys have? Go ahead and put a number on it. Zero doesn't fit it, right? It's at least negative zero, probably 20 or 30, maybe 100 or 3,000. They have zero chance of survival. There's no way it's going to happen.
And first of all, they're not going to survive it anyway, but when you especially consider the circumstances, this fire has been stoked probably by having air pumped into it, but this fire has been stoked 7 times hotter than what it normally is, and it's normally plenty hot to kill somebody. And more than that, King Nebuchadnezzar knows it's so hot, even to get those guys in the fire, he's going to have the biggest, the toughest, and the strongest available to him. And so he takes 3 of his mightiest warriors, who are trained assassins, who have seen and experienced everything in war, and he has them throw them in, but the fire's so hot, it lashes out and it consumes, it kills those mighty men who throw them in. What about the guys who go into the fire? What chance are they going to have? They're in a rush to do it. In our vernacular, they throw them in with their jeans and their t-shirts, with their winter coats and their straw hats on. All that's going to do is just serve as kindling to that fire. There's no way they can possibly survive it. No way, unless God intervenes. And intervenes, God does. Verses 24 and 25, then Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. And he rose and haste, he jumped up. Saying to his counselors, hang on a second, did we not cast 3 men and they were bound? That's going to be important. 3 men bound into the midst of the fire. And look, he says, I see 4 men and they're not bound. None of them. They're loose. They're walking around in the midst of the fire and they are not hurt. No fear in death. And it's strange that the form of the 4th of them is like the Son of God. Wonder who that was. In fairness to the Hebrew text, this can be translated to some of our Bible versions, have a son of the gods, and that could be the proper rendering. But the point is this, Nebuchadnezzar had never seen the appearance of any being like this one. And trying to describe it, it's either he says this is like a son or perhaps like the Son of God. Amazing stuff, isn't it? Verses 26 and 27, then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and he spoke, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God. Notice how differently he's talking about that God now. He's getting to know him a little better, isn't he? He says, come out here. And the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the king's counselors saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. That's no fear in death. Their hair wasn't singed. Their garments that were like kindling on them were not affected. And the smell of fire was not even on them. It's like that one with the appearance like the Son of God formed some type of protective bubble around them. And there simply wasn't any harm that could come to them. Boy, that is a cool historical story, isn't it? But here we stand a good 2,500 years later, so what in the world does it mean for you and me today? So much. I got to thinking about this passage in relation to what Jesus taught when he was on earth in Matthew 13 about the end of the world and the afterlife. I want you to listen to some of this terminology as we go through it. Matthew 13, verse 30, whenever the Son of Man returns, it's stated he's going to bind people in bundles. They'll be bound. He's going to bind them to burn them. Verses 41 and 42, the Son of Man will send out His angels, and they're going to gather out of His kingdom all things that offend and those who practice lawlessness. You know what the issue there is? Guilt in life. For those who have guilt in life, they're going to have to experience this, and He's going to cast them into, you can't make this stuff up, the infinite mind of God. The King is going to have them cast into the furnace of fire. Just like King Nebuchadnezzar's in the furnace of fire that he had. You see what Jesus is telling us? That just like, except way worse, King Nebuchadnezzar's fire, King Jesus has a fire that's stoked 7 times hotter than any fire you've ever seen or known about. It's a fire that's so intense that people are going to weep and wail when they make a contact. But unlike Nebuchadnezzar's fire, people don't die when they're thrown into it. Revelation chapter 14 says in verse 11, the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever. It's stated concerning this fire, Jesus speaks it not once, not twice, but 3 times. It's a place where the worm does not die. You don't get consumed in this fire. It's just endless torture for all eternity. But did you recognize who Jesus is going to use to throw those who are bound into bubbles, into bundles, into this flame? His angels. 2 Thessalonians 1 says his mighty angels, the mightiest men, if you will, the mightiest beings outside of himself that he has. Just like King Nebuchadnezzar got his mighty soldiers to take these guys and to throw them into the fire. And it's a terrible experience. So awful that Revelation chapter 20 describes it in verse 14, that lake of fire, that furnace of fire, this is the second death. Not because it's a ceasing to exist. That's not what death is. Death doesn't mean you cease to exist. The idea of death is a separation. James 2:26 is the body without the spirit is dead. It's not a ceasing to exist. The spirit lives on. It's the same thing with the second death and eternal hell. It's not suddenly people cease to exist. It's a separation. 2 Thessalonians 1, a separation from God, his everlasting power and his glorious appearance for all eternity. This is the second death. It's a forever separation from God. Well, I don't want to be numbered in that group, do you? I don't want to be bound into a bundle to be burned. So how do we avoid that? Remember Matthew 13, Jesus said it's those who have guilt in life who have to experience this. Revelation 20, verse 15 says it's anyone not found in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. But it's back up in verse 6 of Revelation 20 that the description is given as to how we avoid this. Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power. The fire can't hurt them. Remember with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're brought out and all the governmental officials recognize the fire had no power over those guys. Fire doesn't have to have any power over you and me and King Jesus, eternal fire. His flaming fiery furnace either. There's a way we avoid that. How is that? They shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign, this is the key prepositional phrase, with him 1,000 years. Folks, those who are with Jesus cannot be hurt by the flames of hell. Why was it that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were spared? It was because of the presence of the one like the Son of God among them. That's why they couldn't be hurt. And so when the presence of the Son of God is with us, it's impossible for us to be hurt. Now as we go back to verse 6 of chapter 20, we see this is also one who has part in the first resurrection. So it's the one who's with Jesus. It's one who has part in the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power. Did you know there's more than one resurrection in the Bible? The one that gets the most attention is the final resurrection. That's the second one. Everyone's going to be a participant in that, whether you want to be or not. Jesus said, John 5, 28 and 29, believe me, the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves are going to hear his voice and come forth. Everyone's bodies, that's the second and the final resurrection. That's not the one that's being considered here. Blessed and holy is the one who has part in the first resurrection. Over that one, the flames of hell have no power. Folks, there's only one other resurrection that's described in the Scripture other than the final and the second one. It's in Colossians 2, verses 11 and 12. In him you were circumcised with the circumcision made without hands by putting off the body of the sins of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ. Verse 12 says, you were buried with him in baptism in which you were also raised with him. You know what an alternate translation of that term is? Raised, in which you were resurrected with him through faith in the powerful working of God, just as God raised him, his own son, from the dead. And if you've undergone the first resurrection and you've done so to live for Jesus because of faith in him to save you from the eternal fiery furnace, the hottest flames of hell cannot harm you. Which, if you think about it, really makes a lot of sense. When there's a house and it's engulfed in flames and it's being consumed, there's so much threat to everything around, and firefighters show up, what's the first thing they do? They hook up to a cup of water and pour it on top of that big fire. They get some water on their fingertips and they sprinkle it on that fire. They hook up to as much water as they can and they blast the fire. And the water puts out the danger of the flames. Only the infinite mind of God The flames of fire surround a sinner, one who's guilty in life, and it appears there's no hope. Firefighter Jesus shows up on the scene. And not just a little bit of water on the fingertips, not a little bit of water in a cup, but a whole bunch of water completely enveloping that person, puts out the flames of hell's fire for that person. There's no threat from the furnace of hell's fire. If you come into contact with the water through faith in Christ and to live the rest of your life for Him. Can that be said of you? Have you done so? And are you giving your all in service to Him? Doesn't mean that you're perfect of yourself. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego weren't perfect. They committed sins. Daniel wasn't perfect. He committed sins as well. But the regular course of his life and these men's lives were to do the will of God. And when they fell short, they got down on their knees and on their faces, and they didn't pray to a false idol. They prayed to the true and living God, and they begged Him for help to remove those sins from them. Maybe that's what you need to do in your life as God's child tonight. And it's a burden maybe you don't want to bear alone. Well, Galatians 6 says in verse 2 that we're to bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ so that you and I can have the true power of Christ at work within us every day of our lives. So that through Him, when we have no guilt in life, we have no reason to fear death. Even death at the jaws of a hungry lion like Satan, and even death at the tips of the heat of the hottest fire, of the biggest fiery furnace of hell. Because of the power of Christ in us, there's no reason to fear death because there's no guilt in life. If that's the kind of power that tonight you could use at work in your life, why not make it happen tonight and come while we stand and sing this song?